I so wish you could go to the dance, too.
Jesse suddenly remembered Benny and their conversation earlier that day. Did Issa want to go to the dance? Generally, the twins were in agreement about these types of things. But there Issa was, standing before her, looking so elegant and grown up in the peach gown, not looking a bit appalled by the idea of going to a fancy pants dance. What had happened? Jesse had meant to mention the thing with Benny from that morning so they could both have a good laugh about it. But now she wasn't sure if Issa would think it was funny. If Issa went to this dance without her, and with a boy, what would it mean? It would be the first major life event they didn't experience together. Issa, seriously, Jesse said, a little bit louder than she meant to. We have bigger things to worry about than dances.
Yeah,
said Issa dreamily, admiring herself from different angles in the mirror, her impeccable posture making her look stage-ready for Carnegie Hall. Hello, Jesse said, waving her hands in front of Issa's face. Moving? The Biedermann? Whoa, said Allegra. Who's moving? What Biedermann? Issa snapped out of her reverie and looked at Allegra.
We're moving.
The Biedermann is our landlord, and he isn't renewing our lease. We figure we have until Christmas to convince him to let us stay, Jesse added. But that's only 4 days away, Allegra exclaimed. What's your landlord's deal anyway? Jesse shrugged. He can't take all our noise. Or something. Allegra planted her hands on her hips. We need to stop him. Your brownstone is the only reason I don't run away from home and find new parents. Allegra's parents were both pediatricians and spent so much time fixing the health problems of other people's kids that Allegra believed they'd forgotten they had a daughter of their own. We tried to make contact with the Biedermann this morning. Did not go well, Jesse said, then filled Allegra in on the failed breakfast attempt. Here's what's going to happen, Allegra declared. You're going to save your home, and here's how. Jesse clamped her mouth shut as Allegra rattled off a number of unreasonable ideas, including one particularly ridiculous suggestion to purchase the whole brownstone in cash from the Biedermann. And when Allegra ran out of ideas, she talked again about the dance and how amazing Issa looked in the gown. Jesse didn't trust herself to join the conversation, so she slipped out the door without saying anything at all. Oliver spent a dreadfully boring 23 minutes looking through Hyacinth's button collection. When he left his sister peaceful and preoccupied with a craft project, most likely another Christmas gift, he was reminded yet again that he had not figured out Christmas presents. He didn't know how Hyacinth did it. Just 2 weeks ago, she had made him some type of arm warmer contraption. She was like a workaholic elf. Oliver headed up to his bedroom to think about gifts, but when he saw his copy of Treasure Island sitting on his desk, he had a flash of inspiration to avenge Hyacinth's honor. He pulled out a fresh sheet of notebook paper, briefly contemplated the content of his letter, then wrote the following. To the scoundrel on the third floor, I hope your conscience has robbed you of sleep. Being mean will earn you a black spot, and you know what that means. Be nice or watch out. Woe be to the man who does not heed my advice. Signed, your greatest foe. There, Oliver thought. Short and to the point. He was particularly proud of the part about the black spot. In Treasure Island, the black spot meant you were guilty of something and would be fully punished. He thought that lent a certain drama to the letter. He folded the letter into thirds, then slipped it into an envelope. He knew he should be trying to win over the Biedermann, but how would the upstairs neighbor even know that it was him writing the note anyway? It could be anyone. Oliver had really good handwriting for a 9-year-old. He cut out letters from his amazing Outdoor Adventures magazine to spell Mr. Biederman, then pasted them onto an envelope, laying them out like the ransom notes he always imagined getting if someone were to steal Franz or Paganini. That would strike fear into the Biederman's heart. He was sure of it. For the third time that day, a Vanderbeeker kid climbed the stairs to the top floor. Oliver stealthily slipped the letter under the door, then snuck back down the stairs, quiet as a mouse. Oh, yeah. Who is the man? Let it be known that he, Oliver S. Vanderbeeker, was not to be pushed around when it came to his family. When Oliver re-entered his apartment, feeling as smug as a peacock with a full plume of feathers, he ran straight into Jessie. "Do you think I need to dress differently?" Jessie demanded. Oliver winced. This could not end well. "No," said Oliver with complete honesty, hoping that was the right answer. "Why not?" Jessie asked him belligerently. "Don't you think my old jeans and stained sweatshirts are gross? Don't you think I should dress nicer?" Oliver decided to change tactics. "Yes?" Maybe you should get nicer clothes. So you think I'm a big loser too, huh? You and everyone else, Jessie snapped. Why don't you tell me what you want me to say so I can say it and go on with my life? Oliver shot back. Sorry. Jessie didn't look or sound sorry. Well, go eat some ice cream or get a chocolate croissant from Castleman's or something. Jessie's eyes flashed. Apparently that was yet another wrong thing for Oliver to say, although he couldn't imagine why. Chocolate always cheered up his sisters. Oliver inched against the hallway wall, trying to give Jessie as much space as possible.
Listen, I'm an innocent bystander here, Oliver entreated, hands held up in surrender.
He disappeared into his bedroom and shut the door. 2 seconds later, he opened the door just wide enough for his hand to sneak out and hang a "Don't Bother the Beast" sign on his doorknob before closing it soundly again. Jessie stared at Oliver's door and the ridiculous sign hanging from the doorknob. She sighed. She really did want a chocolate croissant, maybe two, but she did not want to go back to Castleman's. She wanted to lie in bed under the covers and feel miserable about life. Jessie's bedroom door opened, and Issa and Allegra emerged, back in their regular clothes. Jessie sighed with relief and took a few deep, calming breaths. Now they could go back to concentrating on what really mattered, like saving their home.
"Jess, we're going to Castleman's for a croissant. Come with us," said Issa.
"No," Jessie yelled, her heart rate kicking up.
I mean, don't you think we should be brainstorming more about the Biederman?
We're just running out for a few minutes. You're the one who always quotes that scientific study about how the chemicals in chocolate help the mind work, Issa pointed out. Besides, I want to talk to Benny.
Jessie's stomach dropped. She could not, absolutely could not, go back to Castleman's today after what had happened that morning with Benny. Especially since she hadn't told Issa that Benny wanted to ask her to the dance. Especially since it now seemed that Issa did want to go to the dance. Especially since Jessie did not want Issa to go to the dance.
I've got a headache, and I have my science fair research to do. And I need to do some sit-ups. You know, keep the body fit.
Stop talking, stop talking, stop talking, Jess demanded of herself.
Jess? Is everything all right?
Issa's brow furrowed in confusion. Jessie nodded. She didn't trust herself to speak anymore.
We'll be right back. Then we can think more about the Biederman. We'll get you a chocolate croissant.
Issa and Allegra stepped away from Jessie, Issa still eyeing her sister critically. Jessie attempted to smile, which only made Issa look more concerned.
Jessie scooted into their bedroom and shut the door. She dropped down onto her bed, covered her head with a pillow, and let out a low, tortured groan. Chapter 9.
"That was weird," Allegra said to Issa once they were outside and on their way to Castleman's Bakery.
"I think this moving stuff is making her nuts."
Her sister was not taking the news about moving well. Issa had to come up with a new plan to conquer the Biedermann once and for all, and she had to do it fast.
Allegra shrugged and returned to her new favorite topic, the eighth grade dance.
"My mom said Carlson will bring me a corsage and I should get him a boutonniere. Isn't that wild? I think corsages are so gorgeous. How do you think I should wear my hair? Should I leave it down? I wonder if Carlson is going to wear a suit. Wouldn't that be so romantic? I'm so excited. Do you want me to ask Carlson whether he knows anyone who would take you? You're so pretty. I know it wouldn't be hard to find someone. I wish I had your big brown eyes and long eyelashes. How about that boy who sits next to you in orchestra? What's his name? Henry? I love his red hair and those freckles. So cute."
Issa nodded half-heartedly. She was glad to be going to Castleman's. She wanted to tell Benny about the move and ask his advice about the Biedermann. Allegra was great, but when Issa talked to Benny, she felt like he stopped everything he was doing and really truly listened to her. They turned the corner and made their way down the street and into the bakery. When they entered, Benny was alone at the counter.
"Hey, Benjamin," Allegra called out, walking in first.
Benny gave a wave. When Issa stepped in, he frowned at her.
But that couldn't be right. Benny had never not smiled when he saw her.
"Hi, Benny," Issa said. She smiled at him, but he was definitely frowning.
"Everything okay?"
"Yup," Benny replied, not sounding like anything was okay at all.
"What do you want?"
Issa stilled.
"Oh, okay. Two chocolate croissants," Issa said, trying to keep her voice steady. "Wait, change that to 3. I want to bring one back to Jessie."
Benny's frown turned into a full-blown scowl, and his eyes narrowed. He pulled out a piece of wax paper and used it to grab 3 chocolate croissants from the glass case. He dropped them into a white bag and thrust it at her.
"Anything else?" he asked.
Issa shook her head, taking the bag as if it were filled with snakes. She handed him the money and waited as he made change. He dropped some quarters in her hand and focused his attention on a point just beyond her left ear, where a picture of a grazing dairy cow hung on the wall.
"Benny," Issa began, clutching the bag tighter, "I wanted to tell you..."
"Issa, don't worry about it, okay?"
Benny said, still avoiding her gaze. "It's not a big deal."
"Wait a second. You already know?" Issa said, confused.
"Yeah, I know. Jessie told me this morning."
"Okay," Issa said slowly. "Don't you have anything to say about it?"
Benny met Issa's eyes.
"What do you want me to say? It's fine. It doesn't matter."
Issa stepped back, her fingers gripping the bag so tightly her knuckles turned white.
"He didn't care that she was moving?
I thought you would..."
"Oh, never mind," Issa swallowed.
"I guess I'll see you later."
Benny shrugged and turned around, disappearing through the swinging doors that led to the back of the store. Issa stood there for a moment, staring at the empty space he left behind.
"Geez," said Allegra, who had been unusually silent during the entire exchange. "What's wrong with him?"
Issa felt tears burning in her eyes. She didn't trust herself to respond. Oliver and Lainey stood at the bottom of the stairs, watching Mama's parade of boxes pile up along the hallway. George Washington was having a terrific time jumping up on the stacks and swiping his claws through the cardboard. Laney pointed to a word on a white box and looked at Oliver.
"That says donate," Oliver told her.
Mama bumped a garbage bag down the stairs.
"What's that, Mama?"
Laney asked. "Things to throw away," Mama replied, wiping her forehead with the sleeve of her sweatshirt.
"But Mama,"
Oliver protested, pointing the tip of his sword at the blue T-shirt poking out the top of the bag.
"That's my favorite T-shirt."
"Sweetie, that was your favorite T-shirt 2 years ago. There's a weird smell to it. It's not even donatable."
"Is that a word?
Donatable?" Oliver dropped his sword and pulled the shirt out.
"Do not throw this away!"
Meanwhile, Laney threw the lid aside from one of the white cardboard boxes, rummaged through the box, removed a pair of old floral leggings, and stretched the waistband around her head to make a hat.
"Laney, don't you dare take anything out of that box without telling me,"
Mama warned. "I don't want to see everything we're donating back in your bedroom."
"Hey,"
said Papa, coming down the stairs with a slight swagger. He wore his coveralls and had his toolbox in one hand.
"Guess what I just fixed?" "Mama wanted to throw this shirt away,"
Oliver said, holding it up so Papa could see.
"Of course she's not throwing that away," Papa scoffed. "You made your first free throw, all net, may I add, with that shirt on. It's got basketball mojo, just like my coveralls have Mr. Fix-It mojo."
Papa and Oliver bumped fists. Laney grinned, and Mama rolled her eyes.
"I hope your coveralls and T-shirt have pack up the apartment mojo," Mama said, "because that's what I need from both of you right now."
George Washington mewled and ran his claws along the side of a box of books, and Mama turned her wrath onto the cat.
"George Washington, if you touch one more box, I'm giving your dinner to the nice kittens living in the backyard."
"Mama, look!"
Laney cried from her spot by the white donate box. She still wore the leggings hat, and the fabric for the legs flapped around her face.
"These are records!"
Mama collapsed on a kitchen stool and took a long drink of water. "I found those at the back of the upstairs closet. They may have been here from the previous tenants."
"Miss Josie can use them. She is a record player."
Mama looked defeated. "Okay, bring them upstairs and ask Miss Josie if she wants them. There's some jazz in there."
"Jazz!"
Laney exclaimed. She grabbed the stack and whispered loudly to Oliver.
"Jazz! The Beakerman likes jazz."
Oliver hushed her, then grabbed the records from Laney's arms and dragged her upstairs.
"How do you know the Beakerman likes jazz?"
he asked when they were out of Mama's earshot.
"Miss Josie said that long ago. He used to listen to jazz all the time," Laney answered. "Can we bring a record up to him?"
"You're absolutely sure? Like, absolutely, absolutely sure?" Oliver asked.
"I'm sure,"
Laney said, bouncing up and down. Together, they chose a record with a picture on the front of a man named Duke Ellington playing the piano. Oliver and Laney crept upstairs hand in hand. A sigh sounded with each step leading to the third floor, where they left the offering at his door.
Chapter 10.
The five Vanderbeeker kids were unabashedly eavesdropping on their mother's phone conversation. They knew from her voice and her pacing back and forth across the room that something bad was going down.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Biederman, that is not enough notice," Mama barked into her cell phone. "It's the holidays. We have boxes all over the place. There's absolutely no way."
Papa came in from the backyard, wiping his hands on his coveralls.
"Hey, kids," he boomed.
"Shh,"
responded the children, waving him away without taking their eyes off Mama.
"We're eavesdropping.
Hyacinth said in a loud whisper, holding her index finger to her lips. Mr. Biederman, Mama continued, her voice going up an octave.
You realize that the apartment is not going to look its best if you show it now, right?
Pause.
Okay, fine. Goodbye.
Mama stabbed a button on her phone and tossed it onto an end table. The Vanderbeeker kids and Papa surrounded Mama, waiting for an explanation. Mama massaged her temples.
Mr. Biederman will have a real estate broker start showing the apartment to prospective renters beginning tomorrow. He strongly suggests that we not be in the apartment when it is shown.
Mama gritted her teeth when she said, strongly.
The broker will try to give us at least 24 hours' notice.
Is that legal? Asked Papa, shocked.
Apparently it's in our lease, and we signed off on it.
The landlord has the right of entry for the purpose of showing the space to a prospective tenant in the last 30 days of our lease. Mama recited in a monotone voice.
You're kidding, Oliver said flatly, his arms crossed.
That makes no sense, cried Jesse. The probability that he could rent this place out would increase significantly if the apartment were vacant.
Her eyes flitted between Mama and Papa.
Landlords can do it, Mama said, but it would have been nice if he didn't.
Oh, fudge. There is so much to do.
Mama looked at the state of the ground floor.
Mr. Biederman's realtor is showing the apartment tomorrow morning at 11.
Papa sighed.
Hun, why don't I take the kids out while you do some packing?
And I'll try to talk to the Biederman, Mr. Biederman, later tonight.
Mama nodded, then went up the stairs two at a time. A second later, they heard her dragging more boxes around.
Someone else is actually going to live here? In our home? Asked Hyacinth, worriedly.
That blows, Oliver said.
He kicked the wall, leaving black smudges on the white paint.
Don't kick the wall, Papa said absently as he adjusted his glasses.
Someone is going to live in my room? Oliver asked.
He kicked the wall again.
They'll probably make it back into a closet, Jesse said. That's what it was before you were born.
But why? My books, Oliver spluttered.
You know what we need around here, Papa said, attempting to change the anxious mood. Some holiday spirit. Let's get a Christmas tree.
What's the point? Jesse said, flopping onto a kitchen stool and burying her head in her hands. We'll have to take it down in a few days anyway.
Yeah, said Issa, Oliver, and Hyacinth in dejected agreement, while Lainey yelled,
Tree! Tree! I want a tree!
Everyone stared at Lainey.
And we can decorate it, Lainey continued, and put lights up. And the presents go under the tree, and I'm going to make ornaments.
She started skipping around the kitchen.
And I'm going to give Paganini a big carrot for a present, and I'm going to wrap it.
Papa looked at the older kids.
So are we getting a tree, or what?
The older kids watched Lainey run over to Paganini, lift up one floppy ear, and whisper all her grand plans for the tree.
Okay, said Issa.
Fine, said Oliver.
I guess, said Jesse.
Yeah,
said Hyacinth. Papa pulled his coveralls off. Underneath, he was wearing jeans and a t-shirt that said, I'm here because you broke something.
That's the Christmas spirit, kids!
The Vanderbeeker kids put on their winter gear and headed out the door.
Hello, Vanderbeekers! Angie yelled as she raced down the street on her bike. Oliver, you owe me a basketball game.
You're on, Oliver yelled back.
A window opened on the second floor of the brownstone.
Hello, dear ones, called out Miss Josie.
Hello, Miss Josie, the kids chorused.
Lainey blew kisses to the second floor, which were returned with equal enthusiasm.
A gentleman in baggy pants, an oversized jacket, and headphones swaggered by holding a rhinestone-studded leash attached to a pocket-sized chihuahua.
"Yo, Vanderbeekers," he said as he fist-bumped each one.
"Yo, Big Z," they answered.
"Did you ever notice?" Issa said to Jesse after watching Big Z stride down the street with his chihuahua skipping behind him.
"That we know everyone in this neighborhood?"
Jesse nodded.
"Feels like Sesame Street."
"It's giving me a Biederman idea," Issa murmured.
Jesse studied Issa, wanting to ask more, but then Oliver threw a handful of pine needles on her head, and Jesse's thoughts turned solely to revenge as she chased him down the street. It was a 20-minute walk to the Christmas tree stand, requiring the Vanderbeekers to cross a bridge that connected Harlem to the Bronx.
"It's tradition," Papa had insisted when the kids suggested they go to the Christmas tree stand around the corner rather than walking to the Bronx.
"When I was a little boy," Papa said in his reminiscing voice, "my dad took us across the bridge to Mr. Ritchie's Christmas tree stand. This was back when Christmas trees only cost $5, Papa added.
The kids nodded. They had heard this story so many times, Jesse could mouth the words along with Papa.
"One year, my dad broke his arm. He couldn't work for 6 weeks while it healed, and we had no money for a tree or presents that year. When I walked by Mr. Ritchie's Christmas tree stand one day on the way to the subway, he asked me why we hadn't gotten a tree yet. I told him about my dad's arm, and he had me choose a tree and take it home anyway. He insisted that the tree would brighten up the holiday, and he was right."
The tree stand was on a corner right next to a set of basketball courts. And when they got there, they found Mr. Ritchie sitting on a blue plastic milk crate listening to a portable radio that gave out static in far greater measure than the Tchaikovsky concerto he had it tuned to. When Mr. Ritchie saw them, he stood up and held out a hand to Papa.
"Good to see you, Mr. Ritchie,"
Papa said as he clapped his other hand on Mr. Ritchie's shoulder. Papa pulled a thick forest green scarf from his backpack, and Issa helped Papa wrap it around Mr. Ritchie's neck.
"From Mrs. Vanderbeeker," Papa explained.
Mr. Ritchie fingered the end of the scarf and gave a satisfied nod and a grunt. Lainey grabbed Mr. Ritchie's hand and swung it back and forth.
"I like your gold tooth," she told him. "I want one, too."
Mr. Ritchie rewarded her with a small smile, his gold tooth glinting against the light of the street lamps.
"We want a tall tree," Jesse said to Mr. Ritchie, raising her arm to indicate the height. "If the tree was 6 feet and 4 inches exactly, it would fit perfectly in our living room."
"It has to be fluffy, not skinny," Oliver added, his arms splayed wide.
"We need one with a good straight branch on the top to stick the star on," Hyacinth said.
"It has to be perfect,"
Issa said with a soft sigh as she fiddled with the buttons on her coat. While her siblings made their demands, Lainey had a different idea of the perfect Christmas tree. It didn't take her long to select the most crooked, most pathetic, patchiest pine tree in the bunch. Then she coerced Papa into dragging the tree to her sisters and brothers. Lainey tugged on Issa's arm to get her attention.
"This is it,"
Lainey declared, jabbing her finger at the tree she had chosen.
"Seriously?" asked Oliver. "You want our last Christmas tree to look like it was pulled out of a forest fire?"
"Ollie,"
Lainey protested, stomping her foot and pouting.
"I love it. It's cute and tall, and I like the branches, and I want it."
The siblings looked at each other. Mr. Ritchie watched the Vanderbeekers with his hands clasped behind him, awaiting the final decision. Issa was the first to cave.
"Lainey has never chosen the tree before," Issa admitted, with an indifferent shrug.
"Yeah, for a reason," Oliver muttered.
"Come on," Jesse protested.
We're supposed to get a tall, fluffy, symmetrical tree. This tree, Oliver pointed to the offending arbor, fulfills exactly zero of our specifications.
I think it looks great, Hyacinth said loyally. After all, Lainey was her roommate.
Lainey's face broke into a huge grin that took up half her face, and even Oliver had to admit that it was worth getting an ugly tree for that smile.
I guess the tree is sort of symbolic, Jesse admitted.
And I want this one, too, Lainey said, grabbing a tiny tree that sat next to Mr. Ritchie's milk crate stool.
She thrust it at her dad while bouncing up and down.
Give a girl an inch, she'll take a mile, murmured Oliver. Honey, we're not getting two trees, Papa said to Lainey.
Not for me, silly. For Miss Josie and Mr. Jeet, Lainey said.
Papa relented. Mr. Ritchie wrapped the tree in netting while Papa pulled out his wallet to pay. Lainey carried the small tree, and Papa hitched the bigger one on his shoulder. The dearth of boughs and pine needles made it light and easy to carry. The Vanderbeekers waved goodbye to Mr. Ritchie, and Papa led the way home. They left the Bronx and went back over the bridge. The sun had set behind the castle on the hill, and the lights from the city sparkled on the water. A tugboat made its way down the river, causing the water to crash into the rocks along the shorelines. 10 minutes later, the Vanderbeekers rounded the corner onto their sleepy street. The church with the stained glass windows was illuminated from the inside, which gave the building an ethereal look. All down the block, trees were wrapped in twinkling white lights for the holidays. Christmas trees and menorahs were displayed in the windows of many apartments. The red brick brownstone welcomed them home with the warm glow of lamps in the ground floor, first floor and second floor. The top floor was, as usual, hauntingly dark. Oliver opened the basement door just as Mama came down the stairs with a big box in her arms.
Home so soon? Mama asked.
We got a winner, Papa replied as he screwed the tree into the holder in the living room.
Mama put down her box and inspected it.
I think you brought home the wrong tree, Lainey interrupted.
Isn't it perfect, Mama?
She asked reverently.
Or not, Mama finished.
She crouched down next to Lainey, who gazed rapturously at the bedraggled tree. Mama took a second look.
I think it's lovely, Mama said. Did you choose it yourself?
Yes, I did, Lainey declared.
By this time, Papa had unearthed the box of Christmas decorations from the depths of the hallway closet. The kids surrounded it, eager to see the contents that had been locked away for the past 11 months. Papa lifted the box flaps, and suddenly there were candy canes that were who knows how old, the nativity that was missing Joseph, the snowman nesting dolls, and the smooth wooden plain ornaments that had belonged to Papa as a child, which Oliver so treasured. It quickly became apparent that this tree offered unique decorating obstacles. The lack of boughs made it difficult to hang the ornaments evenly, so the kids had to hang 10 or more ornaments per branch. Issa and Jesse supervised the decorating, moving ornaments around so the larger ones hung on the back of the boughs and the smaller ones hung from the tips. Mama set out cookies, and after an hour of arranging ornaments and eating cookies and singing and reminiscing about Christmases past, the tree trimming was complete. They held their breath as Papa flipped the switch for the tree lights. The tree was proud and majestic. The brownstone walls pulsed from the twinkling Christmas tree, making the walls look like they were breathing. Papa saw the tree and was reminded of the many Christmas trees he had dragged into the brownstone and set up in that exact spot. He couldn't believe this would be the last Christmas they would spend here. Mama looked at the tree and remembered her children as toddlers when they used to pull down ornaments.
For many years, they had only decorated the top half of the tree, so the ornaments were out of reach. Oliver looked at the tree, and then at the cookie platter, noticing that only one cookie was left. He snatched it before anyone else could beat him to it. Sure, he had already eaten four, but all was fair in love and cookies. Lainey looked at the tree and thought how perfect it was, the most perfect tree in the world. Hyacinth looked at the tree, but didn't really see it. She was thinking about a complete stranger moving into the brownstone, into her bedroom. Issa gazed at the tree and thought about her new Biederman idea, while Jessie looked at her sister, wondering when she should tell Issa about Benny. Chapter 11. That night, when all the kids were in bed, Mama and Papa sat in the living room holding thick ceramic mugs filled with hot chocolate spiced with cayenne and cinnamon. They gazed at the twinkling tree and relaxed into the peace of the evening.
Remember when Oliver was four and woke up early on Christmas and came downstairs and unwrapped every present under the tree looking for a train set? Papa asked.
Mama laughed. Jessie and Issa were so mad. I don't think I've ever seen Jessie's face that shade of red.
They didn't speak to him for a whole week.
But I don't even think Oliver noticed. He was too busy with those trains, Papa said.
Mama sipped her hot chocolate. I always imagined living here forever. I thought Jessie and Issa would leave for prom from here. We would take a photo of them right there.
Mama pointed to a spot next to the large picture window by the front door.
Papa frowned. Our daughters aren't allowed to date until after college, right?
Mama ignored him.
I always thought the kids would spend their entire childhoods here. You know, having the same type of childhood you had. Being supported by the neighborhood. Knowing everyone by name.
Real estate is changing, Papa said. An apartment that holds all of us and has a position for a super doesn't come up anymore.
What about rentals without a super position? Can we afford that? Mama asked.
Papa shook his head.
I've been looking at our budget. I can't make the numbers work. The discounted rent for my superintendent duties makes a huge difference.
I could expand my business, make more cakes and macarons, or something, Mama said, her mind already working out how to manufacture more hours in her day.
Papa shook his head. Hon, we're both working too much already.
Mama laid her head on Papa's shoulder. I hate to bring this up, but what about Ottenville? I'm sure my parents would be thrilled about that.
There was a long pause.
I don't know, Papa said, miserably. I've lived here all my life. Our jobs are here. What about Issa and Mr. Van Houten, the kids and their school, Mr. Jeet and Miss Josie?
Papa stared into his mug. It would be really hard to start all over.
I know, but it might be our only option.
Should we tell the kids what's going on?
Mama hesitated before speaking. Let's wait. Let them have a few more days of peace before we break the news. She caught herself. If we have to break the news. Mama and Papa were so engrossed in their own thoughts and conversation that they didn't hear the two sets of footsteps pitter-patter down the upstairs hallway.
Oliver, wake up! Now!
Go away, whoever you are.
It's me, Hyacinth. You have to get up. Emergency meeting.
Oliver opened one eye. Hyacinth had climbed up onto his loft bed, and her face was 2 inches away from his. Lainey was standing on the ground with her blanket in her hand and a thumb in her mouth. Before Oliver could fully wake up, he found himself being led from his warm bed and into Jessie and Issa's room.
Issa, wake up!
Hyacinth pried open one of her sister's eyelids.
What the?
Issa batted away Hyacinth's hand and rolled toward the wall. Jesse shot up out of bed.
What's going on? Is there fire? Grab Issa's violin.
No fire, but Hyacinth says it's an emergency,
Oliver said, collapsing onto the carpet and leaning against Jesse's bed. His eyelids drifted closed.
This is so important, said Hyacinth, walking to the window and yanking aside the heavy curtains so a beam of light from the street lamp fell right across Issa's bed.
I was taking Lainey to the bathroom, and we overheard Mama and Papa talking downstairs.
Close the curtains, please, moaned Jesse.
Wait a second. Issa rolled back toward her siblings, squinting against the harsh lamplight. Lainey wakes you up in the middle of the night when she has to go to the bathroom?
It's 'cause the monsters,
Lainey said matter-of-factly.
They have big mouths and sharp teeth and gobble me up if I go into the bathroom by myself.
Lainey demonstrated by opening her mouth and chomping down.
Note to self, Jesse murmured. Put nightlight in the bathroom.
Nightlights don't help, Hyacinth informed her. Lainey shook her head, her curls bouncing around her.
The not-nice monsters use nightlights to trick me.
Note to self, Jesse said. Never share a room with Lainey.
Oliver had since fallen back asleep, but woke himself up when he toppled over sideways onto the rug. Hyacinth sighed loudly.
Does anyone want to know what Lainey and I overheard?
Jesse looked at the two sisters. Lainey was not known for being a reliable interpreter of conversations. Hyacinth was slightly better, but sometimes the facts still got jumbled.
Mom said something about prom, Lainey reported. What's a prom?
Suspicions confirmed. Unreliable witness, Jesse mumbled.
Prom is like a million miles away.
She lay back down on her bed and pulled the comforter over her head.
Listen, Hyacinth said, stomping her foot. Mama and Papa are thinking about not staying in the neighborhood. We're leaving Harlem.
Issa, Jesse, and Oliver suddenly looked more awake.
No way, Oliver said obstinately. Papa said we were going to stay in the neighborhood. I remember.
Hyacinth shook her head.
They said we have to move to Ottenville.
What? That's crazy. Ottenville, that's like 4 hours away, by car.
We don't even have a car, Jesse said.
Cars are expensive, Lainey notified them.
Papa said the apartments here cost too much, Hyacinth added.
Issa crossed her arms.
How would I get to my violin lessons with Mr. Van Houten if we lived in Ottenville?
You would need a new violin teacher. Someone who lives in Ottenville, Jesse said.
Impossible, said Issa. I can't have anyone teach me but Mr. Van Houten.
Will Miss Josie and Mr. Ajit come with us? Asked Lainey.
Probably not, Issa said. They have family here in New York City.
I don't think they know anyone in Ottenville.
They'll know us, Lainey said, pouting. We're family.
It could be worse, said Issa. We could be going to, I don't know, Siberia or something.
Jimmy L. doesn't live in Ottenville or Siberia, Oliver said.
Franz hates Ottenville, Hyacinth informed her siblings. So many squirrels.
Stupid Biederman, exclaimed Jesse.
Oliver stood up.
We still have 3 days to convince him.
That's not that much, Jesse said. The probability of success went way down after I screwed up the last mission.
No, Hyacinth corrected her. I screwed up the last mission.
It doesn't matter, Issa interjected. We can still do this.
I had a really great idea when we were walking to get the Christmas tree. Listen.
The kids leaned forward as Issa shared her idea. Then they stayed up for another hour, making plans late into the night.
while the radiators puffed warmth around them. Sunday, December 22nd. Chapter 12.
Help us save our home.
Sign our petition. Only takes a minute.
Mr. Johnson, please sign our petition.
Hey, Miss Walker, did you hear about us having to leave our home? Want to sign our petition?
A cold front had entered New York City the night before, and temperatures had plunged into the 30s. The Vanderbeeker kids were bundled up in their heaviest winter coats, weighed down with scarves, hats, earmuffs, and multiple pairs of socks. Jessie had dressed Lainey in so many layers that Issa feared if Lainey fell down, she wouldn't be able to get up by herself. Together, they canvassed the sidewalk outside their building on 141st Street, equipped with clipboards and pens. The night before, they had made multiple copies of the following petition. Save our home. Mr. Biederman, the landlord at the Red Brownstone on 141st Street, refuses to renew the lease held by the Vanderbeeker family. Without the Vanderbeeker family, there would be a decline in happiness and quality of life in Harlem. Don't let it happen. We, the undersigned, respectfully ask that Mr. Biederman renew the Vanderbeeker lease indefinitely. Since the internet was disconnected, Mama and Papa had gone to the library to use the computer to look up apartment listings. They asked the kids to go to Miss Josie and Mr. Jeet's place because the real estate broker was showing the apartment that morning. It gave the Vanderbeeker kids the perfect opportunity to collect signatures for their petition while their parents were gone. Miss Josie and Mr. Jeet sat on the brownstone stoop, a fleece blanket spread over their laps, keeping an eye on things. The kids were spaced out along the street, flagging down their neighbors and other pedestrians, explaining their plight. Each had his or her own unique approach.
If you sign this petition, I'll give you a giant hug, Lainey said to anyone who passed by.
She was getting the most signatures. Hyacinth was a hit among people walking their dogs. She had baked a fresh batch of peanut butter dog biscuits that morning and was handing them out like Halloween candy. Oliver had called Jimmy L. earlier to round up his group of friends to support the petition. At the moment, Oliver was surrounded by his basketball buddies, who signed their own names and made up additional names and addresses to fill up the sheets.
"I think Don Old Doc is a little too obvious," Oliver said as he looked over Jimmy L.'s shoulder.
"Dang, I thought it was a good one."
Jimmy L.'s voice was muffled by his scarf. He scratched out the fictitious name and wrote Mike L. Jordan instead. Issa was down at the corner talking to Mrs. Castleman.
"We had no idea you were moving, dear," Mrs. Castleman said, patting Issa's shoulder with a gloved hand.
"Benny knew," Issa said, avoiding Mrs. Castleman's eyes as she twisted the pen around the string that attached it to the clipboard.
"Jessie told him yesterday."
"I wonder why he didn't say anything about it," Mrs. Castleman replied. "But he has seemed grouchy lately." She leaned toward Issa confidentially.
"You know how teenagers get.
I'll tell him to come by. You always make him feel better." Issa reached out and grabbed Mrs. Castleman's arm.
"No. No, it's okay. I'll stop by the bakery soon."
Issa's strange visit with Benny the previous day was still bothering her. She handed Mrs. Castleman the clipboard.
"Do you want to sign our petition? We're trying to convince the Biederman to let us stay."
Mrs. Castleman abruptly dropped the clipboard, and it clattered to the street. Issa bent down to pick it up, and when she rose, she saw that Mrs. Castleman's face had turned pale.
"Mrs. Castleman, is everything okay?"
"Yes, yes. Sorry. I forgot Mr. Biederman was your landlord," Mrs. Castleman said, her hands trembling.
"You know the Biederman? I mean, Mr. Biederman?"
"No, yes, not well. I..." Mrs. Castleman pivoted and walked away from Issa.
"Mrs. Castleman?" Issa called out. but Mrs. Castleman waved her arm as if she were shooing away a bad dream. Issa watched her disappear, then crossed the street to join Jesse.
"Hey, Mr. Volus," Jesse called out. "Sign our petition? Hey, you, guy in the black hat. I know you see me. What's your name? Freddy?"
When Jesse paused to blow into her hands and rub them together, Issa leaned in to her sister.
"I just saw Mrs. Castleman, and I think she knows the Peterman," Issa whispered.
"You know, she acted really weird yesterday when I mentioned his name," Jesse said. Before Jesse and Issa could talk more, a new batch of neighbors came out, and the twins got busy getting more signatures. When the Vanderbeeker kids had been out for about an hour, they convened back at the brownstone. Miss Josie and Mr. Jeet looked relieved to go inside.
"My bones are chilled," Miss Josie said as she led the way to the front door. "Come on, Lainey dear. Let's go inside and warm up with a little visit from Paganini."
Lainey put on her panda jacket, collected Paganini, and grabbed the small Christmas tree before heading to the second floor. Pausing before Miss Josie and Mr. Jeet's door, she looked up at the third floor. It was very dark and very creepy up there. Lainey set Paganini's carrier on the doormat, then carried the little tree upstairs. The stairs felt unsteady, as if they would collapse. Was the brownstone trying to keep her from going upstairs? Lainey held the tree tighter and went up three more steps. She knew the Beazleman needed a Christmas tree more than anyone. She got up to the third floor, set the tree right in front on his doorstep, and hurried back down to the second floor and knocked on the door. It opened immediately.
"My dear Panda Lainey," said Miss Josie
after glancing at her little friend wrapped in her panda attire. Panda Lainey stepped inside and said hi to Mr. Jeet, while Miss Josie busied herself chopping carrots, pouring glasses of milk, and setting out a plate of raspberry jam cookies. Panda Lainey unzipped Paganini's bag, and the little rabbit hopped out with a flourish, gazing around for something edible, nose twitching rhythmically. Finding nothing, he made his way over to the bookcase and attempted to dig a hole through the carpet. Mr. Jeet held a small piece of carrot in his hand.
"Paganini, come," he commanded.
Paganini, hearing the voice of the man who gave him delicious carrots, hopped over and was rewarded by a treat and a gentle ear rub. Panda Lainey took turns giving the command, Paganini responding regardless of where Lainey went in the apartment. For his final test, Panda Lainey went into Miss Josie and Mr. Jeet's bedroom, then called, "Come!" Paganini zigzagged his way out of the living room, skidded on the wood floor, and found Panda Lainey with no problem.
"He did it!" Panda Lainey cried, jumping up and down, and almost knocking down a vase filled with wildflowers on the carpet.
Mr. Jeet laughed with a funny he-he-he. Together, Mr. Jeet and Panda Lainey worked with Paganini a few more minutes before ending their training session. After Panda Lainey said goodbye, she couldn't help peeking upstairs at the door to the Biederman's apartment. The Christmas tree was gone.
Chapter 13. Oliver was in a pickle. The Christmas tree already had a substantial pile of presents under it. Not that Oliver was checking out his gifts, but he did notice that many of the presents bore his name, while he had not contributed anything. Now that he thought about it, wasn't it unfair that he had to give 6 presents for Christmas, while Jimmy L., who did not have any brothers or sisters, only had to worry about 2? Oliver was not a good present giver. It didn't matter whether he put a lot of thought into the gift or not. Actually, it seemed as though the more thought he put into something, the less the person liked it. Oliver took his Stegosaurus bank down from the shelf. He pried open the bottom plug and shook the money out. A handful of pennies and nickels fell onto his desk.
Oliver tilted the bank, stuck his fingers inside, and felt around. He pulled out $2, but nothing else. With $2.36 laid before him on his desk, Oliver tried to think back to what he could have spent money on. He guessed he did buy churros almost every day after school from Manny the churro guy, who had a cart he wheeled around the neighborhood. There was something about the fried dough covered with cinnamon sugar that Oliver could not get enough of. Oliver knew that $2.36 would not go far for Christmas presents. Fortunately, it was almost 2 o'clock and time for his weekly basketball game with Jimmy L., which meant he had permission to stop thinking about presents. Oliver went downstairs, where Hyacinth was doing something with yarn and 2 sticks. When Hyacinth saw her brother approaching, she quickly jammed the whole thing under Franz's tail. Oliver scowled. Was she making another Christmas present? On the other side of the room, Mama was baking. She pushed a piece of hair out of her face, whitening the strand of hair with flour.
"Oliver, can you help me for a second? I've got to finish these cookies so I can pack up my baking supplies tomorrow. Can you grab me another bag of flour?"
Oliver opened the pantry door and dragged a 20-pound flour bag over to Mama.
"I'm going to the basketball courts,"
Oliver reminded her before she could rope him into helping more.
"Look both ways before you cross the street, okay? And be back in an hour."
"Yeah, yeah."
"Oliver," his mom warned. "1 hour."
"You could get me a phone," Oliver suggested, grabbing a handful of chocolate chips from the bag on the counter.
"Then you wouldn't worry so much."
"I never worry," Mama said. "And absolutely no phone. I survived without a cell phone until after college."
"That's because cell phones weren't invented way back then," Oliver said, then ducked and ran to the front door when Mama aimed a piece of cookie dough at him.
"Oh, Oliver," Mama called. "I'm going to need some help later, so don't be late." Oliver made a face as he shrugged on his puffy blue jacket and laced up his gym sneakers, shoes his sister described as disgusting and foul. He exited the brownstone and went down the block to the park. At the end of the block, the Baptist choir was rehearsing Christmas carols, their rich voices spilling out into the neighborhood from the open church door. Across the street from the Baptist church was a park with 2 basketball courts, a playground, and a grassy path lined with benches. In the summer, the older people of the neighborhood liked to sit on benches and scold the teenagers who cruised by on dirt bikes. The shaved ice guy would stroll through, pushing his cart and ringing his bell next to the mango lady, who sold peeled mangoes on sticks. The mango flesh was a brilliant orange color, and when Oliver bit into it, the sticky juice would drip down the mango and onto his clothes. In the winter, no one really went to the park except dog owners, who had no other choice, and Oliver's basketball buddies, who believed that a day without a basketball game was not a day worth living.
"Hey, Oliver!" Jimmy L. and some of their buddies from school were already racing up and down the courts.
Oliver jogged over, and Jimmy L. passed him the ball. Oliver dribbled and went for a shot, only to be blocked by Angie. Angie turned and beamed an "I can't help it if I'm that good" smile at Oliver. She was the best basketball player in the 3rd grade, and probably even 4th grade, too. The kids proceeded to push and shove and block and dribble and fake each other out. Oliver wasn't handling the ball with his usual ease, but at least the game was taking his mind off his life. That is, until it started to get windy and his hands cramped from the cold. He knew he needed to get home before his mom showed up and embarrassed him in front of all his friends.
"You're off your game today," Jimmy L. remarked to Oliver.
"I've got troubles," Oliver replied, rubbing the place on his stomach where Angie had elbowed him.
"Yeah? Hey, did you get more signatures yesterday after we left?"
Oliver nodded. Then he reluctantly told the small crowd that had gathered around him about the Christmas present dilemma.
You need a present for Issa?
Jimmy L. asked, raising his eyebrows.
All my sisters, Oliver replied.
Jesse, too?
Dwayne asked with a goofy smile on his face.
All my sisters.